Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to journalist Mike Sager. He just published his second novel, High Tolerance. It's a wild Hollywood tale of celebrity, sex, race, and high-grade designer weed. Stick around, but be warned. Reading this book could lead to a contact high. And watch out for flying bullets. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of star effers, gangbangers, and lost souls who made a wrong turn at the bridge to nowhere in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Top of the list, writers got a better cut of the profits that their talents generate. But right now I'm talking about content that was created that would not otherwise have existed. I mean, have you ever seen Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog with Neil Patrick Harris, Nathan Fillion, Felicia Day, and Simon Helberg? Joss Whedon, his brothers Jed and Zach, and Marissa Tancharden wrote that on spec during the strike. It was terrific. And now journalist Mike Sager, whose work has appeared in Rolling Stone and Esquire, has published an urban thriller that imagines a scenario that took place in Los Angeles for 3 days alongside the 08 strike. High Tolerance pokes a finger in the eye of celebrity, movie stars, rappers, reporters, and more. It's action and drama-packed, and you won't have any trouble imagining it leaping to the big screen one day. Mike Sager, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Does it feel like you've heard that introduction 3 or 4 times by now?
No, it doesn't at all. It's thrilling to hear it. When you make up a story and type it to life, and then people start talking about it as if it really exists, it's the most wonderful experience. I think it really makes it all worthwhile. This thing that started from nothing is now something, and someone has some investment in it. It's really an incredible feeling.
Do you get a better, a bigger bang personally? You've written obviously a lot of magazine work. You've done newspaper work. You've done nonfiction for books. Does it feel better in some ways to produce fiction and have people be talking about fiction than nonfiction?
Well, you know, this is where I started my journey. At the beginning, I was that kid in college who was a history major and an English minor, and my minor was all creative writing classes. And I could write a mean sentence, and I really loved the craft of it and got the opportunity to study under some great people. But I had nothing to say. I wanted to write, but I had nothing to say. And so I found journalism, and that gave me a reason to type. Always go out, find a story. And then I've spent like the last 3 decades sort of like, every story is like an Easter egg hunt or something. You go out, you're trying to find all these pieces and put them together, and then you're trying to display them and do the writing. And along the way, you get knowledge. The stuff I've done, I'm kind of known as a sort of a literary anthropologist. So I've lived with crack gangs, celebrities, high and low. Oddly, over 3 decades, much of my work has taken place in California. I don't know why they once called it the land of fruits and nuts. Maybe that's why. But I think the thing is this is what I always wanted to do, and the beauty of being in my room and creating story, I think my character gets to say it. Writing story is like being a god. You're creating this thing, and nobody really cares about it but you at the time you're doing it. The other thing, just long answer said shortly. Journalism depends on your subject. And that's another person who has will. And it's very often very difficult to get the story that you need to come back with. And that's a game in itself. So with writing a novel, it's sort of this blessed thing that goes on inside of your head.
I find it in general, I can't say this is always the case, but a lot of the men and women that I've spoken to as Mr. Media the last couple of years who have moved from journalism into writing fiction, I find that they write the more believable fiction because they've been so grounded in facts for so long. But if they were good storytellers as journalists for newspapers and magazines, even to a lesser degree for television because it's a different use of words, that they tell good stories. I just had last week a fellow named Kieran Crowley on the show, who was a New York Post crime reporter for 35 years, I think, mm-hmm. and now is writing fiction under his own name. And it grabs you. And in his case, I'm a little surprised because that tabloid background, you would think, well, you know, they're so used to writing short and everything is sensationalized. It's really good stuff. And, you know, I told you before we started the actual interview, I mean, I'm within 10 pages of the end of High Tolerance. It took me a little bit to get into it, but I got about a third. Once I was a third of the way in, it just grabbed me and took off. And, you know, you could see the benefit of those years of magazine and newspaper writing, I think. I don't know that everyone would agree with that.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting, too, because while there's nothing stranger than truth and nothing more particular than the details that you see, there's also the line that you can't cross where truth seems fake. Like, no one would believe this if it was really happening. So, you know, there's an element of how to tell a story, too. And you know, when you have the material, it's a matter of getting out of the way of the story and then embellishing and adding to it. And again, as a journalist, you always wish, God, if only this could happen, you know, and then so as a novelist, it can. And but on the other hand, too, my fiction writing has made me a better nonfiction writer as well. And it's all of a piece, and I wouldn't want to do just one thing. I you know, and I like doing different kinds of journalism, too. Like, you wouldn't think it, but the celebrity interview is like the hardest journalism you can do because they don't say anything. whereas, you know, writing some crime story like The Devil and John Holmes, you know, the thing that became Boogie Nights, mm-hmm. I mean, all you have to do is order the pieces and get out of the way, you know, right. Just be minimalist. So, it's all good.
And you're right. People don't quite get that about celebrity interviews. I've done a lot of that over the years. You write and have been with Esquire for quite a while. And one of the interesting things there is I find – I think I can always tell when the celebrity profile is less than cooperative because two things happen. One, of course, you get very few quotes in the story. But the second is that the writer has had to usually invent – an interesting way to get in and out of the story that wouldn't have happened had they gotten more from the celebrity. And the other thing I think is that people just think, oh, they're celebrities, they have fabulous lives, they have lots to say. A lot of them, they don't really have that much to say. You know, they may act well or produce music or whatever, but as people, they're just not that interesting, a lot of them.
Well, I think that's true. They, they're very, very beautiful. And that's like the amazingly remarkable thing. And there's, because of that beauty and the well-manicuredness of them, it's just sort of like amazing to be with these people. And they do have a charisma. But I always remember one time this actress won the Academy Award and she got up. It was Nicole Kidman and she got up. It was and she invoked the director, I guess, writer of the film, Baz Luhrmann. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, I need your words. She sort of said that. And I mean, it's true. They need words. They're really good at, because you and I both know it's really hard to take a script and then spit it back out and look like anything but an idiot. Mm-hmm. And these people play all these different characters. And what it is they're like, they're faking. They're good at taking stuff that's not them and faking it. So And, you know, in many cases, you know, instead of studying the world, they've studied acting and the small pieces of how to make your face look good when you're, which is, you know, acting is difficult, how to be still, you know, all the elements of acting, or it's a craft like writing and anything else. But no, there, celebrities aren't the most interesting. But what's interesting is celebrity and the effect it has on these people. For High Tolerance, I had the opportunity to spend 3 days and nights with Paris Hilton. I've written about a million celebrities before, but I wanted some more things, for my story. And it was an amazing experience to be with her, who's known for only for celebrity, but who also is so much different than her reputation. Just for starters, she doesn't talk like that. Paris Hilton doesn't have that high squeaky voice. She has a lower voice.
No.
That's like the voice that she does when she does a character.
You're killing me.
But it's really weird because she does. In public, she plays a character. And how bizarre is that? And, you know, I thought it was really important to have a really strong woman character also in this book. Not only because that's what is, thing nowadays, because most of our readers are women. You know, men, I really feel like John Updike and Philip Roth and probably couldn't have a career writing about, you know, writing about the men and men's needs and men's point of view and all that stuff that dominated literature at one time. I feel like that's one reason why I have several characters, because I wanted to address sort of some of that as I went through. And I also wanted to address, you know, the bigger issues of life in these here times.
Well, your main female character, Angelica, is, it was interesting that you talked about that, because I kept thinking, okay, where's the part where we find out she's just a flake or she's just this, but she is strong. I mean, she considers the words and the parts, and it's important to her that, and she comes off very well.
Well, you know, the thing is these women, she was modeled on like Hilary Swank, Diane Lane, Michael Douglas's wife. I can't remember.
Catherine
Zeta-Jones. And one thing that all of these women have in common is their incredible drive to become what they are. And they all begin when they're very young. And they really know what they're doing, and they're very savvy, and they are playing a role, and they take control in their own way. And then there's the fallout of once they get what they're after and how it affects them as well, because there's a reference to Planet Angelica, and it's like being in a celebrity's orbit for a time, you know, and following them around. It's just like this whole other Earth 2 of rules and regulations, and everybody knows, and it's like having a workplace employment where everybody has a shared sense of understanding. Well, it's planet celebrity. And the other thing I find really interesting that I kind of discuss in this book is what I call the celebrity use curve, and how, you know, we sort of worship these people, our modern pantheon of gods, and we worship them, and we build them up to such an extent that it's almost like they make us feel bad for being so much better than us. And so we start like taking them down. Hmm. You know, everyone that we really love, just wait for it. We're going to really hate them really soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very interesting phenomenon from the inside of the eyes of these poor human beings, you know, in a way. I mean, they have a good life, but it's very interesting. And I do think celebrity in many ways defines our times.
Well, so we talked a little about the female lead. There's three, loosely put, three writers in the book. Let's see if we define them equally. I mean, I think of Sulkoff. I hope I'm saying that the way it's intended. He's a TV writer. He writes a show called High Tolerance. There's the reporter, Calvin Scott. No, is that Scott? Yeah, there's the newspaper reporter, and he covers the rapper, the rapper impresario guy, who I don't actually want to say his name.
Chili T.
All right, thank you. I just can't bring myself to say his full name.
It's a controversial name.
Yes, it's very clear.
He's a controversial rapper.
Right, and I consider him to be a writer because, you know, rappers, they write. It's not it doesn't always enjoy the same level of respect, but it, you know, it's still words. It has to
Good
be
point.
Written, and it you know, there's rhythm and what have you. Of the three of them, the newspaper reporter gets the least respect in the book. Actually, the rapper gets more respect for his product and for his life. Can you talk a little bit about how you viewed these three? And if you want to disagree with me, including
no, I think it's a really interesting point of view. I didn't even think of it, you know, that way. And again, it's going back to the point before. It's interesting to hear feedback from a reader. It's wonderful. I mean, in this world you create, and it makes people think of things. You know, of course, Chili T and Sulkov are more main characters. You know, Chili T is like, I spent time with Ice Cube back in the day. Eazy-E, I wrote about him. You know, used to be with Rolling Stone, so I was like on the, you know, hip-hop train early on, like following that. Sulkov is a character who's a writer, but he's not writing right now because of the writer's strike. But he's a writer, and he's a father, and he's my, you know, Rothian, Updikean sort of thing. And my novels, this is my second. The first novel had, as one character, a 29-year-old father who was just, his wife had just given birth. And so that's like one of the subplots, is like this sort of, you know, journey of man. And so Sulkov takes me there to a journey of manhood as well for this. He's 39, you know, he's going through stuff. His kids, like, doesn't need him quite so much anymore. You know, he's in a transitory phase. You know, the reporter guy, you know, this whole thing, this whole story, I think we can say it involves a sex tape. So, you know, and there's a lot of this debate about celebrity and sort of what's public knowledge and, you know, all of these things. So the reporter is a way of you know, getting all that stuff going. And it's also a way of reflecting how it felt to gather all of the knowledge that's in the book, mm-hmm. in a way, and the role that you play as a journalist when, you know, they just really don't want you and they don't really remember your name. I mean, I've interviewed Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, and I'm sure that one didn't cross the other in the hall and said, "That Mike guy, I know you talked to him too. He was a good guy, right? Blah, blah, blah." Or, I mean, I remember I interviewed George Clooney and Julia Roberts together for Ocean's 11 once, and we sat for a whole interview together for lunch, and then I let them interview each other. It was some real weird conceit for Esquire. And do you know, at the end of the thing, it was on my tape, but so I wouldn't have seen it in person, because it was kind of the ultimate interview, because I got to leave my tape recorder for them to interview each other, and I just they did the job. But so midway through the interview, Julia was referring to me, and she called me "that reporter fellow." I mean, she didn't even know my name. And that's fine, because I don't really exist.
Right.
And they're not supposed to know my name, and I'm not their friend, and it's fine. And I think one of my successes, like one time, my first story for Esquire, they assigned me to do Robert De Niro. And they said, "Okay, well, you have a half an hour and to interview him." And De Niro, like, was saying nothing. So at 25 minutes, I stopped. Well, his agent stuck his head in and said, "You have 5 more minutes." And I said, "That's okay. I don't need them." And then I told De Niro, "Don't say reporter. Never gave you nothing." You know? And do you know they called me back and asked me if I needed anything else? I mean, I think that's, like, the secret of this whole job, is, like, you kind of know that they're not going to give you anything. And, you know, the difficulty comes when, you know, at different magazines, the celebrity profile is taken differently. Like, recently I've done 3 profiles for InStyle, 3 cover stories for InStyle magazine, where, you know, realism is taken as, I just did Jennifer Lawrence upcoming and for their December cover. And I wrote her maybe as you would write an Esquire cover, sort of very real life. She was kind of appeared to me as a college kid, and it was early in the morning, and she was sleepy, and she was just in her first day of vacation. And, you know, and I wrote it like that, and it was sort of said, well, this is kind of negative, meaning realistic, you know. So, you know, the interpretation of everything is fun and interesting, and that's kind of what gets to go into the book. None of this stuff ever gets into your stories. So that's why the journalist is in there. I think nowadays the journalist is the one that does muck up the sauce a lot of times.
That's really interesting to hear you talk about this stuff, because I'm in the point where I'm moving away from, not giving up, but moving away from strictly doing the biography and as told to stuff, and have had the opportunity to co-author a novel 2 years ago, and another thing I did this year had more of a fiction slant to it. And I'm thinking about, as I'm working on them, I'm thinking about things that have come up in the course of, you know, being a reporter and a journalist, and things are slipping in, and I'm starting to see kind of the path there, where a lot of the things that, you know, you're sworn not to reveal, or like in my case, sometimes contractually you have to keep to yourself. Well, that doesn't mean you couldn't disguise them in other ways, and they can't pop up and be, you know.
Right. That's what's horrible about journalism. You can't, if only I could do this, fabrication or whatever they call it. Composite, that thing which is like the dirtiest word in journalism, is the tool of the fiction writer. And the more realistic, the better. It's a wonderful opportunity, you know, to be able to do it. And, you know, as far as what you were just saying, it's sort of like I've written like every kind of thing. And I feel like, in a way, I'm always that, going back to that cub reporter at the Washington Post. Well, I started out as a copy boy, and then I was on night police, but then I was what they call general assignment on the city desk. And they would just like literally scream out my name and hand me a piece of paper, you know, and say, here's the story, you know, go do this, and you'd have to go do it. And you learn all these tiny little pieces of everything. And that's what's weird about being a journalist. What's wonderful today about the internet to me is that my teeny bit of knowledge helps me be able to find stuff so easily. I remember in the old days living in Washington, D.C., and wanting to research something and having to go down to the Martin Luther King Library with dimes for the microfiche machine.
Right.
And I used to carry them in a sock, because it made a good weapon, you know, in case, like, because it was like in not a good neighborhood in Washington at the time where the library was. Now it's like right near the new stadium, basketball stadium, arena, whatever they call it. But God bless the internet and all those little dribs and drabs of knowledge that you pick up, which makes you probably an insufferable, you know, human being, but does well for our jobs.
Can we see that sock of dimes in a book at some point? God, I love that. I won't steal that, but I'd love to see that reference somewhere.
I'm surprised it didn't work its way into my first book, which was called Deviant Behavior, which is set in Washington.
There you go. Well, all right, so let me come back full circle to the book, High Tolerance. You set this during 3 days of the 2008 WGA strike, the Writers Guild of America strike, for those of not paying attention to that. And I wondered, I didn't see any evidence. Are you a member of the WGA?
No, I'm not. Oh, right. I do have friends, and I did go up and like in there, I describe one day of walking in the picket line, and I actually did that with a friend of mine. And almost everything in here, it's like reported or, you know, one of my big influences in journalism and in fiction was Tom Wolfe, who really believed in reporting out his nonfiction, his reporting out his fiction. Even as he brought fiction to nonfiction, he brought the nonfiction reporting to fiction. And I'm very much in that thing. So the strike was like a great way to sort of hold up life. It's hard to describe. Like, I went to college, and for a while I was like a political science major. But then I switched to history because it was over. And you could study it better. Like, political science was like, made me nervous because it kept going on even as you were trying to study it. And as a journalist, I'm the same way. I never try to write until I'm finished all my research. Mm-hmm. And with this too, it's like 3 days. It's like people can go through something. I wanted to have an understandable story, and something happened. and yet, like, it's kind of microcosmic. I don't know, my journalism is known for, like, I focus on a single character. And I think I always think to myself, I'm just not smart enough to carry all these characters in my head, but kind of, you know, I understand the world very microcosmically by details. In journalism, as a professor, I talk about this thing I call the bowl of details, that you collect all this stuff and then you use it like a mosaic, to build like a mosaic, a found art mosaic of stuff. And that's kind of what I hope this thing is. And then the pleasure as a writer is taking every piece from the bowl, and it's not just a piece, it's like you have to write the words to make it. So you pull this like image out of your mind, and then like you find the words to convey, you know, that thing. And it's just such a wonderful, I teach these kids at Words Alive, it's a program they have here for kids and reading, most of them underprivileged. And I like to tell them that reading is really the first interactive game, because the writer writes, but you don't write everything. So the reader reads and they fill in the blanks. It's like, why do you go to the movie and not like the movie of the book? Well, because you as the reader filled in the blanks, but in this case, the director filled in the blanks. And so you have this, it's an interactive game. So I mess with the reader's heads. I'm really aware of that, always in a good way. I'm going to be nice about it. It's like a nice prank. But, you know, it's like, I'm so aware of that idea of building this imagery and interacting with the reader and creating this storyline to draw someone in. Like, and I'm always conscious of that, almost like a hand over hand as the story goes along. When I worked at the Washington Post, my boss was this guy, Bob Woodward, of course, who was, you know, the big Woodward and Bernstein, you know, who did the Watergate stuff. And his big thing was, holy shit detail, he said. Pardon my French, but I'm just quoting now. Holy shit detail. And I sort of feel like I try to get that into every parent. Not, you know, and there's a fine line between how much is right and how little is right. But, you know, it's sort of like, it's such a gracious honor to have this person spend their time like reading what, because it's so like onanistic to think that like this person's going to spend all their time like with reading what you want them to read. So I'm going to like make sure it's good for them. You know, I mean, I'm just going to make sure I'm the best lover ever. And you're going to get like what you deserve, because you're, and I love doing it in the process. So, you know, it's like I hardly met anyone who's read my book.
There'll be more.
People say they do, but, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can.
I haven't heard that much.
You can tell. I mean, you know, you can tell when people have read something and when they haven't. I
sometimes you're worried, like, you know, they read, maybe some people read and they, you know, they don't say much. It's very weird, though. A lot of my writing has been met with, you know, I have a small fan base, a lot of whom are writers, I think, and they don't really say much. You know, they're like, another writer is not going to say that much to you, unless he's a young guy and he's coming to you and he wants, you know, guidance. And then, you know, you hear from them, but then they're just young guys, so what do they know?
So yes.
They're asking me, what do I know? So, you know, anyway.
Well, speaking of guys who know something and or don't, or maybe, I mean, you've had this long association with Esquire, and they have pretty much maintained, you know, there've been a couple dips in the, you know, in the road a few times, but they've pretty much maintained this very high standard of journalism, and not just, oh, it's high journal, it's quality journalism, it's the new journal, but things that are not only interesting to read and are written and presented in an interesting way. Is it attributable to David Granger, the editor at Esquire? Is it the institution, all that went before him, and he's just carrying on this high tradition? Or is it the quality writers that are there? I mean, I noticed.
Not to blow any smoke up the butt of the guy who decides how much money I make, but I mean, when we all got there, and it's really weird, this is the really remarkable thing. I went from Rolling Stone to GQ. GQ was trying to beef itself up and had this really amazing run in the early 90s as a great magazine. And, you know, it's still a good magazine. But really, it was just the magazine at that time. And David Granger and Tom Juneau and a bunch of people, and I was working there as well. I wasn't working actually with those people, but we knew each other, of course. But and now moving to Esquire, he went to Esquire when basically it was a hulk of a title. I mean, a husk of a title, I should say. There was nothing much there. And over the last 17 years, when we've basically, it's been the same group of people with new younger editors, of course, always coming in also, but the same group of people, you know, he's done amazing stuff. And I think because he really cares and he's always tried to like do new weird stuff and different stuff. And sometimes he gets shit for it. Like they'll always try stuff and some stuff flies and some stuff doesn't. But he's always trying, and I think that's an amazing thing, especially, you know, in a corporate world where, you know, the business people don't really understand what it takes to put out art, and they're always squeezing us, and we've gotten less and less and less, you know, over a few years. And now, like, everybody's seizing onto the internet stuff, and they're putting money into it, but we don't really know how it's going to pay money back, and it's very weird. So, no, I, you know, David Granger is Esquire, you know, and Esquire and all the guys he's, you know, brought together to do his bidding, because at every magazine it is like there's this first name guy who's David, you know, he's in charge. And it's in style, it's Airy, you know, and at Rolling Stone, it's Jan. Who it's great. I see he's working with his son now, who says I can talk to my dad because he doesn't scare me when he yells. You know, which is great because Jan Wenner was a little scary when he would yell. Esquire is Granger, and also, you know, there's a staff of people like my editor Peter Griffin, Mark Warren, AJ Jacobs, who's been on your show, I know.
Yep.
You know, they've made their own institution. And I'm not sure, you know, looking back through modern history of, you know, this kind of thing, if there's ever been a shop of people who's been together for 17 years, you know, maybe William Shawn, but I'm not sure how long he was there, with the same group of people putting out this thing that's maintained, you know, vitality in a really shit market. So,
well, you know, I was for years, you know, I loved Playboy. I read Playboy, you know, year after year after year. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, I just kind of reached a point where it just bored me, and it wasn't there. And it's interesting if you compare. I just set aside GQ because I find it incredibly inconsistent. I don't even give them the time of the day for the most part. But Esquire and Playboy, if I put them side to side, they both have these long histories. But what's interesting is in the modern era of magazines, when a lot of magazines are failing and falling by the wayside, they've gone in two very different directions. Playboy has focused more and more on the girls. Its internet presence is the girls. Its TV presence is the girls. Esquire has held fast to the content and the articles. And I mean, it does have it does lean a little more on pretty girls than maybe it did before, and you know, the photo spreads online. You can see a series of photos of very attractive women. The joke from a pretty girl.
Women we love. That's one of the franchises.
Yeah,
you know.
But it's I like that Esquire has taken that. It has a different kind of internet presence. It's now, you know, be interesting to see what they do with the TV channel. But it will sustain and keep the magazine.
Well, you know, what's very interesting is, in a way, both of them are doing the same thing in different ways, because Playboy has now put a lot of resources into their internet thing. And actually, the Playboy website is not run by Playboy. It was licensed out. So there's a Playboy mobile app that I have a column on, believe it or not, called Go Ask Sager. You know, it's behind a paywall, and I don't know about stuff behind, but it also appears on Kinja as a free thing, which is part of Gawker.
Okay.
But so they're paying me a little money to write a column, which is fun, and they're trying to recruit some writers to do that. They have a young guy that they took from Chicago and brought him to L.A., and they're doing all content site. And they're with sort of Maxim-like women. And there's no booty, you know, no down there or up there. There's just, which, you know.
Are you saying that there's no there?
Yeah. And there's also, I don't think we can discuss what I was just going to say next on national podcasting, so I'm not going to go there. But anyway.
So there's no there, and now you're not going to go there either. Okay.
Right, exactly. No, there's, I mean, they've always had good articles.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny to say, and they're, you know, their mobile app is kind of amazing, and they're kind of fostering some really good young writers. I'm not sure if anybody reads it.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't even know it existed, and I have this nickname, Mr. Media. I didn't even know it existed, frankly. All, you know, my sense of them online is strictly photos.
Look up Go Ask Sager on Kinja.
Okay, I'll do that. I will check that out. That'll be interesting.
It's cool. I actually enjoy it a lot. I write these weird first-person columns about life, you know, going on an RV trip with my son or going to Vegas, or I went to this factory where they were making marijuana concentrate, which is the next, like the next future version of marijuana. It's like not even, it doesn't smell or anything. It's just vapor. It's really weird. So I got to do a lot of weird things for them. So it's fun.
Interesting. Well, let's, before we have to wind up here, I want to talk to you a little bit about this book and other books. You have the Sager Group. You are publishing kind of under your own umbrella. And I wondered first how that's going, but also you've had, I think I saw 7 or 8 films have come from stories, articles that you've done, including Boogie Nights and Wonderland. And I wondered if this is partly, I mean, does this give you more control over that sort of thing, should it happen?
Well, no, I mean, it gives me the same amount of control, really, a little less exposure, you know, because I'm exposing things myself, I guess. I've sold 7 or 8, I think about 4 have actually become movies. Veronica Guerin with Cate Blanchett was another one that was a good one. But I mean, it opens up the possibility for that sort of in the same way. It's always that the writer usually maintains the rights to his work as as a published author with a novel anyway. So it doesn't really, I mean, what the Sager Group does is give me the opportunity to say yes or no to what I want to do and what friends want to do, or what people, you know, artists, it helps artists enable themselves, and it also harnesses the means of production, which is a phrase I got from Ice Cube, the rapper, by the way. I always have to credit him with that. When I was, you know, with him, when he was just leaving NWA. But publishing is great. I love the art. You know, there's design involved, there's covers involved, there's working with other people, which I don't do. You know, I have a programmer in Transylvania whose last name is Vlad, I swear to you. We have a Japanese designer who just moved here from Japan with a special visa, and another young designer, young black guy, and the Esquire's art director. I'm working on these series of women in journalism series. It's 4 books. We did a textbook, myself and the head of the former head of journalism at Illinois, who was my mentor at the Washington Post, Walt Harrington, we did a textbook. We basically got into a fight one day on the phone, which we used to like to do. And he was a professor, and he's saying journalism was dead. And I'm saying, no, it's not. I have all these young guys calling me all the time that are writing amazing stuff on the line and in magazines. And I said, we should do a collection. So we did that. That was one of the first things the Sager Group did. And now it's actually a textbook in like 3 or 4 different classrooms across the country, and hoping for more. But when we did that, there were only 3 women in it. We had 2 women researchers from 2 different colleges putting together the parameters. And you had to be under 40 years old, and you had to write in third person. That was the only, you know, parameters, basically. And we only got a couple of women who were really good. So because there are not as many women being published is the problem. So we went on the road. We were doing a conference at University of Missouri, Mizzou. They have a great journalism school, amazing school. Like 3, 4, or 5 of the writers in the books had gone there. So they're having this conference, and these 2 women came up to me, and they're like, you know, and this wasn't the first time I'd heard it. And I said, well, let's do something. So they started this website called The Riveter, theriveter magazine.com. It's long-form writing by women for everyone. It's a great site. And then I've brought them under the umbrella, so they're helping me do two books. One's called News Women, 25 Years on the Front Page, which includes like Dana Priest, Loretta Tofani, Edna Buchanan. You know, it's like women journalists, newspapers, you know, like legacy of the last 25 years. Because there's just no textbooks that have that. And then the other one we're doing, which is turning into this two-volume set, is called The Stories We Tell, which is women, journalism, long form, you know, nonfiction, you know, long creative nonfiction. We've got Joan Didion in there. She said yes, which was, and actually The Stories We Tell is a line from hers. You know, we're going to do that too. So we've got a whole woman's thing going and a bunch of other books. People enabling themselves. We haven't quite gotten the marketing thing down, but I have this theory that at the end of the rainbow of thumbs up, there's got to be a pot of content. So the SaviorGroup.net, it's content, baby.
Oh, it's nice to hear you mention Dana Priest. Way back in the 1980s, I used to sit behind her in the Clearwater Bureau of the what was then the St. Petersburg Times.
Now, kidding.
Before she won her Pulitzer, before she was on TV all the time, and always I and a couple of the other guys always had a little crush on her.
Oh, she's cool. You know, have in the Book of Young Journalists, we have Michael Krause from he's now, you know, they call it the
Tampa Bay Times.
Right.
Yeah.
He's there. Mm-hmm. And but I think his original story that we run had run in the St. Pete paper. Mm-hmm. So we had to kind of, it was weird, we had to get permission from a now defunct operation to run the piece, which I have to say, that was the big challenge, was getting everyone to run the pieces, let us run the pieces for free, because they are textbooks. So that'll be the next challenge.
All right, now I got to correct you. The St. Petersburg Times, not defunct, just changed its name.
Well,
I'm married to that organization. I don't want to imply. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah. I can't let that one fly. I got skin in that game.
No, you do.
But
and if your wife still has a job in that business, then she must be amazing, because only amazing people are left.
Well, and she is a lifer. She is definitely a lifer. So listen, while we have you in your office there, I wonder if there is anything. Take advantage of the medium. Is there anything on your desk, any souvenirs, any knickknacks of all the places you've been, all the people you've been with that you could show us? Oh, look at this. We're getting the tour. Wow.
Let's see.
Nice.
I think we should just go over to this shelf over here.
Sure.
These are some of the books I've published, and the ones on the shelf, a lot of them are ones I've published previously, but some of these ones in the little case, whatever you call it, mm-hmm. standing up or mine, as well as what we're here today to talk about. High tolerance. but anyway, these are some of my babies. If you can see them,
and
that's Marlon Brando. He kind of started everything for me. Can you see him?
Yeah.
The Washington Post sent me to find him. It's a great assignment, very controversial. There's my first front page story at the Washington Post. Agriculture's dumpster enough to warm the scavenger's heart. That's a whole story. I can't go into that now.
Okay.
Pictures of me with the 600-pound man, Vince Neil. That's the king of Nepal over there.
Uh-huh.
He's the one that got killed by
his son,
nephew.
Right?
Yeah, his son or whatever it was. And Rick Ross, if you can see that near the wonderful vacuum cleaner handle. I recently, in the 80th edition of Esquire, I had a piece where I spent a bunch of time with him, Freeway Rick Ross. If you remember the Iran-Contra scandal, mm-hmm. Drugs for money, money for guns, all that stuff. Well, the drugs all came to South Central, and they went to one guy, basically, and he invented crack. He invented gangsters selling ready. He called it Ready Rock. Mm. And he invented and taught more people how to cook crack than anyone else ever, and is probably responsible. a really interesting story. He went to jail when he was 25. He was illiterate. He taught himself how to read and then got himself out on a loophole.
Wow.
Interesting piece.
Mike, if you would tilt your screen a little bit down. We can get, there you go. We don't want to cover you up with text. All right. Well, that was great. Thank you for the tour.
I look better that way. I don't know.
No. No, I think bald-headed guys with beards and glasses of a certain age are very distinguished.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I was the only person like that. And then I was coming for an interview, and I described myself. And the woman said, "Which one?" And I got a little upset for a minute, but there was nothing I could do, really.
Jeez. Oh, man. Well, listen, this was great to talk to you about. I enjoyed the book a great deal. And let me tell people, folks, you can find Mike Sager's new novel, High Tolerance, hopefully in great stores everywhere. But if not, you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And you've got, of course...
Or Amazon.
Well, here's the secret. Oh, click on Mr. Media. It'll take you to Amazon.
Oh, okay, cool.
and it's available as an ebook, of course, so you can get a trade paperback edition. Your website, is it MikeSager.com?
It's a MikeSager.com, and that's my personal website. And for journalism students, there's some tips for journalism that a lot of people like. And then TheSagerGroup.net is the book company, and there's a bunch of stuff, everything from... Mandela Was Late by former Seinfeld writer Peter Melman, who's appeared on your show.
Correct.
To a young adult series, a mystery and adventure called The Inner Movement. And a very, very fun nonfiction oral history by the underground poet Greg Girding. It's an oral history of people of intimacy. Hmm. It's called I'll Show You Mine. It has, you know, sort of like basically the sex talk with, you know, 20 different people or couples, and very frank and interesting.
Hey, very cool. Well, and are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
I'm on Facebook at the Sager Group, and Twitter is The Real Sager. I once discovered in a story for Esquire that there were very many Mike Sagers, so I'm The Real Sager on Twitter. Please follow me. I guess we're supposed to say that, right?
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, Mike, pleasure to get to know you and have you on the show. And thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at Stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's Stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at Audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.